Welcome to the Minnesota State Capitol in St. Paul for Governor Mark Dayton's eighth and final State of the State address to a joint session of the Minnesota House and Senate in the, needless to say, packed chamber of the Minnesota House of Representatives. I'm Bill Werner, Minnesota News Network, joined by Hamline University Professor David Schultz. Professor, thank you for taking some time to join us in the cave tonight to do some color analysis of what we anticipate for the speech tonight. Eminent Scott Peterson is on the House floor, gauging reaction not only here at the Minnesota Capitol, but also on the Twitter universe. He will join us a little bit later on. Shortly after the governor's remarks, we will hear the Republican response to the State of the State address. That will be delivered by House Assistant Majority Leader Dan Fabian from Rosol. This, needless to say, is a momentous occasion. It is an occasion with much pomp and circumstance, and marked by, of course, the additional occurrence that this is Governor Mark Dayton's last speech. The governor arriving in the chamber now actually came in, it looks like, through the retiring room, doesn't it?
Yes, it is a retiring room, correct.
Yeah, which is a little bit unusual. The governor generally will come in through the main doors of the House chamber. And he, of course, is shaking hands with the dignitaries present to the Speaker of the House. He's going to start pretty much right on time, Professor Schultz. So this will save us from having to speculate, and we can analyze afterwards.
Exactly. Perfect.
I believe the governor is there. He's at the podium.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
All the members of the House of Representatives, of course, on their feet. Some whistles in the chamber, presumably from the Republican side.
Yes.
Assume, Professor Schultz.
Thank you. Please. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Here's the governor.
I present to you the governor of the state of Minnesota, the Honorable Mark Dayton.
That announcement made by the Speaker of the House, Republican Kurt Dowd, and of course still speculation on whether
he's going to run.
Whether Speaker Dowd might be vying for that office. We don't know that yet.
We have a lot of speculation on who still might enter.
That's for sure.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Madam President, Majority and Minority Leaders and members of the Minnesota Senate, Mr. Speaker, Majority and Minority Leaders and members of the Minnesota House of Representatives, Madam Chief Justice, and the distinguished members of the Minnesota Supreme Court and Court of Appeals, my fellow constitutional officers, and my fellow Minnesotans, especially my about-to-be five-year-old grandson, Hugo, sitting in the front row up there. Some people suggest that I conclude my speech now to make certain I can walk out by myself. However, this is my final State of the State address, and there's more I want to say, so cross your fingers, Hugo, because here we go. As I prepare to leave office, I want to thank the people of Minnesota who twice voted for me to serve as their governor, and thank the legislators, supporters, and allies who helped us succeed. To my fabulous staff, fantastic commissioners, and other key appointees, you have my eternal gratitude. You deserve so much of the credit for our administration's successes. Your dedication has been extraordinary, your wisdom exceptional, and your resilience remarkable. I want to thank my family, who have counseled me wisely, supported me steadfastly, and endured me patiently. My sensational sons, Eric and Andrew, daughter-in-law, Corey, grandsons, Hugo and George, my former wife and dear friend, Alida Messenger, my father, siblings and spouses, uncles, aunts and cousins. Without you, I would not be here today. My father used to say, time flies when you're having fun, and even when you're not. Being governor was not fun when I took office in January 2011. State government was in terrible financial condition, with a $6.2 billion deficit forecasted for the next two fiscal years. The state had, quote, borrowed almost $2 billion from our public schools, and it used millions of dollars more in shifts and gimmicks to mask the full extent of the deficit. You might remember that I campaigned for governor in 2010 on a pledge to raise state income taxes on only the wealthiest 2% of Minnesotans and not on the other 98%. In 2013, with DFL majorities in both the House and Senate, we passed that 2% increase on the top 2% of our taxpayers. The change has made Minnesota's tax system more progressive and has been crucial in turning chronic budget deficits into steady surpluses, paying off the state's debt to our schools, eliminating other fiscal shenanigans, and building a $1.9 billion budget and cash reserve. We restored fiscal stability and integrity to state government. I thank those Minnesotans who did pay higher personal income taxes and the great many others who expanded their businesses and created over 280,000 new jobs since I took office. The hardworking people and businesses of Minnesota are the sources of our renewed economic prosperity and the foundations of our future success. What must we do to continue that success? Tax cuts are some people's answers. Tax cuts are always some people's answers. In 1997, what is now the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence published its first How Does Minnesota Compare with the Other States? In fiscal year 1996, Minnesota's individual income tax collections per $1,000 of personal income ranked us third highest among the states. A Republican governor, third highest income tax state. In fiscal year 2002, the last year of an Independence Party governor's term, Minnesota still had the third highest personal income tax collections among all the states. In fiscal year 2010, the last year of my Republican predecessor's term, Minnesota's personal income tax collections were per $1,000 of income were the sixth highest among the states. In the Center's last report, published last September, Minnesota's personal income tax ranking for fiscal year 15 was again sixth highest, the same as it was in fiscal year 2010. Minnesota has not been a low-tax state during my career, and it's fortunate because states with the lowest taxes generally rank among the lowest in per capita income, household income, educational attainment, home ownership, and public health. By contrast, Minnesota's total job creation, average household income, and state economic output have improved steadily, both in real terms and relative to other states. It's not that raising taxes is by itself a good thing. It's that investing those revenues in education and infrastructure produce far better returns in improving our economy's vitality and our residents' well-being. They produce more jobs and better jobs. If we and our successors preserve our state's fiscal integrity and invest our present tax system's resources in even better education, infrastructure, and transportation, we will continue to offer better jobs with higher incomes and other benefits to our residents. If we don't, we won't. During my two terms, we've made substantial increases in our state investments in education, in our people, starting from early childhood to universal all-day kindergarten, all the way through elementary, secondary, and post-secondary education. This school year, nearly 80,000 children are attending all-day kindergarten and early learning programs thanks to those wise investments. And those 80,000 children are getting better starts in school and in life because of your wisdom. Business after business tells me the number one reason they're locating or expanding in Minnesota is because of the superb quality of our workers. One major industrial operation in northern Minnesota told me just last week that his company has 14 plants throughout North America. When he's recruiting new customers, he brings them to his plant here in Minnesota to show off his workers' exceptional productivity, the quality of their products, and their skill in making them. Those qualities are ingrained in our state's people, which they pass on from one generation to the next. But they must be nurtured, trained, and employed to achieve their full potentials. Minnesotans understand the importance of education, but what most don't realize is how badly the state's financial support has slackened in the years before I became governor. When I started, the state's funding for elementary and secondary education per $1,000 of personal income was in the bottom half of the 50 states. Most recently, we ranked 18th, according to the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. That's better, but it's not good enough. And it explains why our public schools are constantly having to hold special property tax referendums to ask for what should be funded by the much more progressive state income tax. With us tonight is Mr. Corey Bowman, a high school teacher in Mound West Tonka School District, who is Minnesota's Teacher of the Year. Mr. Bowman. It's thanks to you, Mr. Bowman, and Minnesota's thousands of other dedicated teachers that last year our students once again topped the nation on ACT college entrance exam scores. Our teachers and our students deserve our strong support. State government's funding for higher education has also declined. In 2012, state support for the University of Minnesota, Minnesota State, and financial aid was, in real dollars, the lowest it had been since 1981. Once again, we have restored some of that loss, but we still have shifted too much of the cost of attending our state colleges and universities onto students and their parents. Both Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota were funded well below the system's request last year. The university just announced that with $10 million of additional state funding in this session, it will not need to raise tuitions next school year. I will include that $10 million in my supplemental budget request. Along with an additional $10 million from Minnesota State. And I urge the legislature's bipartisan support. Our two outstanding post-secondary leaders, University of Minnesota President Kaler and Minnesota State Chancellor Malhotra, are here with us tonight. You recognize them, please? Mr. President, Ms. Chancellor. I salute you both, and thank you for your service. Further damaging the future success of our colleges and universities is the chronic inadequacy of our state's capital investments in their campuses. It's almost impossible to provide world-class educations in antiquated buildings with leaky ceilings, dilapidated bathrooms, worn-out exteriors, and in classrooms without advanced technologies and other learning aids. That's why my bonding bill provides more money for capital improvements on Minnesota State and University of Minnesota campuses than either system requested. I know they asked for less than what they need because they thought that that was all the legislature would support. Well, surprise them. If we invest more in education, future generations of Minnesotans will be more successful. If we don't, they won't. Another priority of my bonding bill is infrastructure. Since I could not meet all local needs, I made as my priority water infrastructure, especially projects to make our residents' water cleaner and safer. In addition to the $1.7 million in last year's bonding bill, I would provide the Public Facilities Authority with an additional $167 million to ensure that more Minnesotans have the clean water they need. Over 170 local water infrastructure projects across our state cannot move forward without this funding. Please provide that safety in your bonding bill. Another crucial area for infrastructure investments is in transportation, which was also poorly financed for years. Everyone driving in our state knows that traffic congestion and highway conditions keep getting worse, wasting their time and straining their sanity. After years of my urging, the legislature has started to increase state expenditures for road and bridge repairs and improvements. Unfortunately, most of that additional money has been taken from the general fund, $588 million last session. It's a convenient solution for as long as state budget surpluses continue. However, some people are now proposing to transfer all revenue collected from sales taxes on motor vehicle repairs and maintenance from the general fund to the highway fund and even dedicate it constitutionally. Such a transfer would cost the general fund $1,354 million over just 4 years. It would further undermine the structural surpluses in future bienniums. While I support additional investments in our transportation infrastructure, I strongly urge legislators to consider carefully the fiscal impacts of this deceptive solution, and instead look to sustainable long-term financing for the roads, bridges, and modern transit systems that Minnesotans need. People of Minnesota want to see an evenly divided legislature. Restoring fiscal stability to our state budget is one of the most important legacies that I can leave to Minnesota. During my final year in office, I will not support any budget, tax, or policy proposals which would threaten that stability. I urge legislators to do the same. We face other major challenges. After several years of lowering the state's uninsured rate under the Affordable Care Act, 116,000 Minnesotans have lost or dropped their health insurance during the past 2 years. Our state's uninsured rate jumped from 4.3% in 2015, the nation's second lowest, to 6.3% last year. The number one reason was that people could no longer afford it, or they were fed up with being charged higher premiums and deductibles for lesser coverage. Therese and Brian Ramsdell, who who grow corn and soybeans and raise beef cattle in Butterfield, have joined us here tonight. Therese and Brian, thank you for being here. You feed our nation, you feed our world. We thank you. Like most Minnesota farmers, Therese and Brian are being hurt by exceptionally low commodity prices. And now they're being charged $33,000 this year for their health care premiums. $33,000. That's outrageous, and it's wrong. Meanwhile, some insurance companies have stopped offering individual coverage because of lower returns and Washington's uncertainties. This exodus has caused many Minnesotans, especially those living in rural areas, to lose their previous insurance carriers and often their established networks of doctors and providers. Pay more for less has never been popular. People quickly ask, what are my other options? Right now, for affordable health insurance, they have none. However, the legislature has the opportunity and the responsibility to offer Minnesotans another option. For 26 years, MinnesotaCare has given lower-income working families quality, affordable choices when purchasing their health insurance. I believe we should give all Minnesotans that option. After its startup, the operating cost of this new Minnesota Care buy-in would be paid entirely by its members' premiums, so there's no ongoing expense to other taxpayers. For some families, the Minnesota Care buy-in may offer better health care coverage at lower costs. That is exactly what competition is supposed to do for consumers. Legislators have a very clear choice. All of you can side with big insurance companies who don't want this competition, or you can side with Minnesotans who do. Our Minnesota lawmakers face another clear choice this session. They can side with the NRA, who strongly opposes common sense solutions to reduce gun violence in our schools and communities, or they can side with the school children of Minnesota who are begging us for it. And I salute all of the Minnesota students who took a stand today and marched to tell us adults that they need safe schools. On Monday, four state senators courageously stood together on the side of our students. I thank them for their legislation to extend criminal background checks to all gun purchases and require all lost or stolen firearms be promptly reported to law enforcement. Would you stand in ruling and be recognized and thanked, please? You should take attendance at these things. It's a good way to find out who's. Those changes that they've proposed will help keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. They will save lives. I want to thank the many legislators in this chamber from both parties who are fighting for these and other life-saving measures to reduce gun violence in our state. I will sign any of that legislation the minute it reaches my desk. It's helpful when you clap. That gives me a chance to hydrate it. The recently passed federal tax bill is extremely complex and defies a simple solution. If we conform state personal and business taxes completely to federal changes, some Minnesotans would owe more state taxes, while others with the same incomes would owe less. If we do nothing, the federal changes would cause significant increases in other people's state taxes. Either way, thousands of Minnesotans would be hit with state personal income tax increases. That's not fair, and it's not right. Minnesotans deserve better. Last year, the legislature reduced business property taxes for each of the next 10 years. The federal bill just cut the corporate tax rate by a whopping 40%. Combined, they provide huge tax cuts to Minnesota businesses. So our number one priority, which will be reflected in my budget on Friday, should be tax fairness for individual Minnesotans and their families. I'm very proud of our state, proud of what Minnesotans have accomplished here. U.S. News and World Report recently rated Minnesota the second best state in the country, up from third best the previous year. USA Today said we're the nation's best run state. AARP ranked us the very best state in which to retire. And CNBC says we're the third best state for business. We're not perfect, but compared to everyone else, we're very good. I say again that the credit belongs to the people of Minnesota. We are our people, but we're only as good as all of us are. That means all of us. In a state with rapidly changing demographics, in which 19% of our residents are now women, men, and children of color. That is a very different complexion from years ago, and some folks still resist that change. If we can educate them to move beyond racism, religious bigotry, and other hatreds, they will see that this new diversity is crucial to our state's future success. There are simply not enough native Minnesotans to drive our future economic growth. There are already too few unemployed workers to fill our state's current job vacancies, and that labor shortage is expected to become even more acute. The additional workers we need to expand our economy must come from newcomers to our state. Adjusting to this new reality is hard for some Minnesotans. Trying to push back Minnesota 50 years is neither a realistic option nor a good idea. I want to be very clear. Minnesota is an inclusive and welcoming place for all, and we all stand together in making that statement to everybody in Minnesota. During the past few years, our state government is led by example. Since 2015, the percent of state employees with disabilities has grown by 40%. The percent who are men and women of color has increased by 50%. That's important progress. We have much more to do to ensure that our state government better includes and serves the rich diversity of our state. As I conclude, I want to acknowledge all the important issues I did not address tonight. But my time is running out, so I must leave them to all of you. I want again to thank the people of Minnesota who have supported my career in public service. It has given me so much, and so much more than I could ever return. Best of all are the extraordinary people I have encountered throughout our state. People I could never meet any other way. Shouldering their hardships and celebrating their achievements has cemented the bonds of our common humanity. We are each so uniquely different, yet we are all so much the same. From my experiences in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and the poorest parts of New York City, I have come to realize how much our lives are prescribed by where we land at birth on this planet, and then by the economic and social environments in which we live. I believe that most of us are incredibly fortunate to live in Minnesota. Despite our challenges, there is nowhere else that compares. Previous generations worked hard to build and then leave us what we have here. Now it's our responsibility to make it still better for generations to come. Our model should be this magnificent state capitol building, which just a few short years ago was in dangerous disrepair. But all of us here set partisanship aside. We came together, worked together, and even kicked ourselves out of this building until its restoration was completed. Look at what we accomplished by working together. Just imagine what more we can do if we continue. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Governor Mark Dayton delivering his eighth and final State of the State address here to a joint session of the Minnesota House and Senate in the House chambers at the state capitol in St. Paul. And applause all around, of course, handshaking, the governor shaking the hand of the Speaker of the House, the Attorney General, the Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, waving to the assembled lawmakers here. Yep. Hamline University Professor David Schultz is with us now as we take a look at this speech. And I guess, Professor, at least for the first part of it, it was fairly predictable, wasn't it, as far as what he laid out?
It was very predictable, and what we expected him to do, and he did, was to sort of do what? His statement of accomplishments, to sort of say that when I took office 8 years ago, the state of Minnesota didn't look very good, and look at what I've done during the course of that time. And in the process, then sort of transition to terms of saying, and here are the challenges of what we still need to do. But no question about it, it's a recitation of sort of what? His accomplishments, his report card.
An interesting comment that he made, and I it didn't elicit any boos, which maybe wouldn't be appropriate, although you kind of half expected it, where he said, Minnesota is not a low-tax state, and that's fortunate.
Yes.
Meaning there's money available to make investments. Well, Republicans have a lot different view of that. And I think he really toward the end of the speech, about the last 5 minutes of it or so,
right?
He really laid out that issue by saying that the federal tax bill provides huge tax cuts to Minnesota businesses, and his number one priority when he lays out his supplemental budget, which will be at the end of this week, right, is tax fairness for individual Minnesotans and their families. And I think that got the biggest applause of this speech.
It was. I was going to say, what's interesting, when he ran for office 8 years ago, he talked about saying that if elected, he was going to raise taxes. Democrats were scared of talking about that, but he made it clear going in that he thought that the way to sort of, you know, help Minnesota was, we're going to have to raise taxes and invest in our infrastructure, in our schools and so forth. And that's what he talked about in his speech. He stuck to that, and he's proud of that. He's, if I can use that phrase, he's an old, unreconstructed, you know, DFLer.
And saying, that's exactly right.
And to the end, he's saying, We don't tax for the sake of taxes, but we tax for the purpose of what? Investing. And we got, and remember when he started to list it here and said, we're ranked really well by AARP, by CNBC, all like that. That's his, you know, that's his proof. He's saying that we've done that, and look at how we come out as a result.
And this has been, and there were legislatures that were more amenable to that than the current legislature and allowed him more success in that particular area as governor. And but that really lays out the whole thing, doesn't it?
Right.
The whole dispute, yeah.
Right. I was going to say that the core of what this speech is about tonight, as the core has been about for, I'm going to say, for the last 8, 10, 20 years in Minnesota, is about taxes. It's about the ideological divide between Democrats and Republicans over taxes. Are taxes good for investment in terms of the infrastructure? Are taxes a hindrance to business development? And I think everything comes down to what Minnesota does in response to the federal tax cuts.
Do we
conform with federal tax cuts, or do we go our own way? That determines everything else.
Hamlin University Professor David Schultz is with us here as we do this analysis after the fact for the governor's final State of the State, Governor Dayton's final State of the State address. Let me ask you this, because this issue of taxes has been a sticking point throughout his term, certainly when after Republicans took control of the Minnesota House and Senate. And so here we have, again, the battle lines drawn.
Right.
What are your predictions in terms of what could potentially happen in that area this legislative session, as Governor Dayton's last legislative session, and a session before an election, I would think would be key as well.
Right. I was going to say the governor's interests depart from the Democrats, even in the House and the Senate at this point, because he's not running for election again. He has a legacy. You know, when he laid it out here, he wanted to get the state on the right course fiscally, right course in terms of education, right course in terms of infrastructure development. He has one last shot at doing it. I think he's going to try this one more time. Remember, last session he tried to do it, didn't get what he wanted. He did a line item veto. It didn't go anywhere. I think he's going to make one last shot, but I'm not persuaded it's going to go anywhere, because I don't think the Republicans in an election year are going to at all swallow the idea of increasing taxes.
That's going to be a tough battle. Hey, we'll get back to this in just a second, because we've had Scott Peterson, I think, maybe on the line here from the House chamber, unless he had to go and do a post reaction with the leaders. Perhaps he had a run for that, so maybe we'll come back to him a little bit later. Let me ask you this about the prospects for overtime,
right?
Because that has happened in the past, certainly in terms of special sessions and going right up to the deadline at the end of the fiscal year and so on and so forth. Does that happen this time?
I don't think so. And the reason why it won't happen this time is for the fact that, unlike last year, which was a budget year, the legislature had to finish the budget or the government shut down. Here, theoretically, if they do nothing this entire session, nothing happens on one level. That they can walk away, not pass a bonding bill, not pass tax conformity, not do anything, and the legislature and the state government still funded until next year. So I don't think you have the same pressing fears that the system's going to, or the state's going to shut down. So I think the Republicans, when they get to somewhere around May 21st, they're going to adjourn, and the governor's not going to have much ability to be able to get them to come back.
I think we may have Scott Peterson on now. Scott, are you there?
I am here, Bill, yeah.
Yeah, Scott's on the House floor. And what kind of reaction are you getting there? And you've been watching the Twitter universe a little bit, too. What are folks saying?
Well, I can tell you in the room, one of the key points that the governor made that drew the most applause, he received a standing ovation, pretty loud applause for his remarks about the investment into early education.
Yeah.
And I can tell you on the Twitter sphere that a lot of people that are involved with education, the education unions, teachers, they're very vocal on Twitter and on social media. So he was receiving a lot of praise and a lot of support from educators, obviously, for talking about the investments in early education, as well as the support that he received in the room here.
Hang with us, Scott, as long as you can. I know the leaders are going to come out fairly soon and react to this, the Republican leaders. But Professor Schultz, is that surprising that the governor has so much solid support in the education committee? It's really education community, rather. It's really not, is it?
It's not a surprise at all. But what's also interesting, I'm going to throw in here, is that what's becoming clear, if I can bring in some of my classroom work here.
Yeah, okay,
I've had several speakers come in from a variety of different things. things. And what's the number one issue that we're hearing out there is child care. Child care, rural Minnesota, urban areas. And I think there is an emerging consensus, whether it's early childhood ed or something, that we need to solve what's emerging as a major, major problem in the state. And so I think the fact that the teachers and education people support, no surprise, but I think that is also the closet issue, I think, going into the 2018 elections. How are we going to pay for it? Because you go even to rural Minnesota, you go to Republican areas. This is a major problem people are talking about now.
Scott Peterson, if you're still with us, give us some other maybe impressions of the speech, because you were right there. We're sitting here watching the feed down in the basement of the Capitol, but you were right there on the floor. Tell us a little bit about what was the sense of it, particularly after last year, the frightening situation when the governor fainted at the podium. He looked solid this year, didn't he?
I would say so, and I can say honestly, I did feel a sense of relief in the room once the address was over and everything went smoothly. People were a little bit hesitant at the beginning and kind of looking to see how right. Did he look? Does he look healthy?
I think his color looked good. His color looked good, didn't it, Scott? He seemed robust and rosy faced, and so on. And
he even joked about the drinking the water at one point. He said, "Keep applauding so I can drink and hydrate." Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, exactly. But that was yes. I mean, certainly everyone was looking at that, and so. Other things in terms of just some. Yeah, I think maybe you're gonna have to run. It sounds like. Okay, very good.
I am.
Yep, he's got to roll, folks. Because right. Thank you, Scott. Eminent Scott Peterson on the House floor. He needs to go, and because the Republican leaders are coming out, and they're going to react obviously to this speech, and we'll bring some of that a little bit later. So
right. I mean, the other thing I want to throw in here too is that while this was a speech, clearly in terms of sort of a recitation of what he's accomplished and what he likes to still do, I also want to view this as a speech that is setting the terrain for the 2018 elections.
Okay.
Because the themes that are here are going to be the themes, I think, that you're going to see in the governor's race and in the House races at this point. Over what? Taxes, early childhood education.
Yes.
We're going to see it about infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. So,
but it all kind of comes back to that tax.
It is the tax. It is the tax. I mean, I want to take it even back before the governor, before Dayton was governor. Remember how when Pawlenty was governor and you had several Republicans bolt to vote for the increase in the taxes?
The transportation tax.
The gas tax. They essentially got evicted from the Republican Party.
Exactly.
Right.
Sure they did. Yeah.
Right. And so I think in the same way at the national level, taxes have become a line in the sand for Republicans. The Minnesota Republican Party is the exact same thing at this point. And they're just not going to go along with any kind of tax increases. That's why at one point, I think the biggest sort of, what is it, both applause and booth, if I can put it together here, came when he was talking about maybe the first half of his speech, all about Republicans proposing transferring, was it all revenue collected from sales tax on motor vehicles into a general fund, to the highway fund.
And he set that up as if he was going to say, this is not a good idea, but he just stated the idea and the Republicans all applauded.
And then he said,
"Well, hold on a second now here." And then he says, "This is not a good idea." And then the Democrats applauded. And then he said, "Well, this is what Minnesotans now. You see what a divided legislature is like."
Exactly. Yes,
one half or a little bit less than half standing up and applauding, and a little bit more than half standing up and applauding to the other end of the same sentence. Almost is what it came down to.
Yeah. The other thing we were looking at when we were listening to the speech that struck me, and in reading it here, also we have a copy of it. A lot of statistics and numbers. Didn't that strike you too?
Yeah, well, and the governor is very much a policy kind of person.
Yes.
Yes, right. And I don't think there are a lot of things that he could be accused of, but not knowing the material is not one of the things that he could be accused of.
Yeah.
He could be accused of. Whether that plays out well in a speech, that's open to judgment. And
right.
People will have their own opinions on that particular thing. I think it's fair to say that the statistics he used frame the issues quite well.
They do frame it well.
However, there is disagreement on where to proceed from here on many of these issues.
Right. One of the things that many of us learned in speaking is that sometimes what you don't want to do is have too much in terms of statistics. What you want to do is paint stories. And if I were going to do a critique, when I got to sort of his discussion about infrastructure and transportation, done is I might have talked about the fact that it's spring and we're all driving over potholes at this point, you know, and use that as maybe my sort of my story or something like that.
He did that at one point on infrastructure at the colleges, right?
Right,
the maintenance
right.
of university buildings. And I'm trying to find the exact,
that was the part
exact
we talked
reference
about,
to,
yes.
to it here. In the speech, but where he was talking about college and university, he says it's almost impossible to provide world-class educations
right.
in antiquated buildings with leaky ceilings,
right.
dilapidated bathrooms, worn-out exteriors, and in classrooms without advanced technologies and other learning aids.
That was a good paragraph. That was a good part of his speech where he painted an image that people could relate to.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and that's going to be a big part of the debate in this upcoming legislative session is the size of the bonding bill. And he mentioned
right.
that he's got a bonding proposal out for $1.5 billion. The Republicans are saying probably about half that.
That's right.
It maybe ends up right around $1 billion. That's traditionally where it ended up. But perhaps they had a bonding bill last year, which would the Republicans are saying that chews up part of that number, and therefore it maybe would be smaller than $1 billion.
Yeah.
So that's going to be one of the big debates in this legislative session as we move forward as well. And that's got a lot of importance not only to higher education but also the communities in greater Minnesota for water infrastructure and all sorts of other public works kind of system. That's a big deal for I don't think I'm saying any secrets that a lot of folks in greater Minnesota are watching that.
Oh, they
officials.
Right, right. And they're counting on that. And what's interesting about this is the fact that not only is there a need, but the bonding bill is the kind of thing that generally legislators like to pass in an election year because they can go back to their constituents and say, we've delivered. We've delivered on, you know, on helping provide that money to fix up a school, or we provided money to fix this road and so forth like that. So what we're going to really see at some point along the line here is to what extent, even though there may be disagreements on the size of the bonding bill, there's actually support, I think, to be able to do the bonding bill because I think legislators in an election year want to go back home and say, we did something.
Yeah, and you know, and that's a thing that is really brings in a lot of legislators from greater Minnesota into the fold, wouldn't you say, Professor, is the bonding bill specifically?
It does, because what it speaks to is the fact that, again, we know that a lot of parts of rural Minnesota really, you know, don't have the tax base to do projects, and they really have an overwhelming need to, again, fix those schools or fix, you know, whatever needs to be done or something like that. And these are good investments in the community. There's no question about it.
Professor David Schultz from Hamline University with us. And now we just have arrived, one of the Republican leaders of the Minnesota House of Representatives who is going to deliver the Republican response. It's Representative Dan Fabian, who hails from Roseau. Thank you, Representative, for joining us. I know you have some remarks prepared, and I will turn it over to you for the Republican response to the State of the State address. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'll try to be brief, but I have my comments here. Well, good evening. Hello, Minnesota. My name is Dan Fabian. I'm the Assistant Majority Leader in the House of Representatives, and I want to thank the Minnesota News Network for an opportunity to deliver Republican response to the Governor's State of the State address tonight. This was the Governor's final state address, and while we're on opposite sides of the aisle and have had many disagreements over the years, I wish him well as he nears the end of a lengthy career in public service to the people of Minnesota. The state of our state is strong thanks to the work accomplished by a Republican-led legislature and signed into law by Governor Dayton. Sometimes, you know, it may seem like all you see in the news is a partisan conflict, but I want to take folks back to last session and talk about the excellent bipartisan bills that have helped boost Minnesota's economy, lower our unemployment rate, and put more money in the pockets of Minnesota families and hardworking folks all across the state. In 2017, the Republican-led legislature passed the largest tax cut Minnesota has seen in two decades. Under this tax bill, an estimated 284,000 seniors are no longer paying taxes on Social Security benefits. Farmers with ag land saw their taxes go down thanks to our bill to reduce the unfair burden farmers have to pay for school bond referendums. College graduates with student loans, their debts are already seeing a $500 first in the nation tax credit when they file their taxes. We added a tax subtraction and credit for parents saving for college through 529 plans. Main Street businesses saw their property tax bills drop, and we got rid of the unfair automatic yearly tax increase on the statewide business property tax, and we also expanded the dependent care credit for families with young children. These are just some of the middle-class tax policies we put in place, already helping to grow paychecks and help hardworking Minnesotans keep more of their own hard-earned money. In addition to tax relief, this legislature passed a major road and bridge infrastructure bill last year. It was the largest single investment in our roads and bridges without a gas tax in state history. It also included $16 million for Minnesota cities with populations under 5,000, which is extremely important for rural Minnesota communities like those I represent. And it also helps to repair 95 bridges statewide that are on MnDOT's priority list. I heard from folks in my district and across the state about the impact rising health care costs were having on their families and finances. Excuse me. That's why Republicans advanced meaningful reforms that tackled our state's MnSure mess, helped stabilize our individual market, and delivered key reforms that held health insurance rates flat for the first time in years and actually reduced them for thousands of Minnesotans. We passed important bills to bring more competition into the market and expand the number of health care choices for people, particularly in rural areas. Finally, on education, and having been a teacher and a head coach for 34 years, I know the value of education, and we know education is a crucial component to the future of our state. Last session, the legislature boosted funding for our K-12 schools by an average of $306 per student. Pairing increased funding with Republican-led reforms to tackle our state's critical teacher shortage and keeping the best teachers in the classroom is a recipe to ensure that kids in every corner of Minnesota get the education they deserve and need. Even when we disagree at times with the governor, we all share the goal of moving Minnesota in a positive direction and working hard for folks all across the state. Working together and finding compromise for the folks of Minnesota is the kind of work that may not make the headlines, but I can tell you it has helped lay the foundation for a strong state economy in our future. As we start looking ahead to the rest of the 2018 session, we have a handful of priorities on which we hope to find agreement with the governor. First and foremost, we must conform Minnesota's tax code to the federal changes. While federal taxes are simpler, you may even be able to do them on a postcard. If we don't conform, you'll need a phone book for your state taxes. Republicans will fight to hold Minnesotans harmless as we adjust to the new tax changes and ensure folks can take full advantage of state and federal tax relief. In the coming weeks, we will unveil this legislation and work with Governor Dayton to ensure Minnesotans are spared headaches when they go to file their taxes next year. Our work will continue on fighting health care costs this session, too. Just this week, Republicans heard a bill in committee to cut the Obamacare tax Minnesotans pay on their health plans and limit the ability of bureaucrats at MnSure to limit the number of health plan choices. Reducing this health care tax will save Minnesota taxpayers $30 million on their health care, another small but important step we can take to lower costs for families who've been hurt by Obamacare. We also know that school safety is on the minds of many Minnesotans following the tragedy in Parkland, Florida. And I can tell you, our hearts break for the families of victims, and we all share a very sincere desire to prevent these senseless acts and protect our kids. Excuse me. Since session began, we've already held hearings on at least a dozen bills that would bolster school safety and give tools to local school districts to keep their students safe. These bills include giving school districts flexibility to make safety improvements that best fit the needs of their students and their schools, increasing funds for school resource officers, training for school district personnel to identify warning signs, and more. There are broad areas of agreement with Governor on school safety and mental health. We will work with him on this important issue as session continues, because we all share the goal of keeping our kids safe. Recently, a Star Tribune series and subsequent report by the nonpartisan legislative auditor revealed a systematic pattern of abuse and neglect in some senior living facilities. and the failure of our Department of Health to adequately respond and handle complaints made by victims and their families. Our Subcommittee on Aging and Long-Term Care, led by my fellow Northwest Minnesota Representative Deb Keel from Crookston, will be looking closely at this issue and working with the governor to respond and to ensure we make changes needed to protect our seniors and vulnerable adults. We cannot let our loved ones down. This is a critical issue that we all must address. Minnesota is also in the throes of a devastating opioid crisis. In 2016, Minnesota had more than 400 deaths attributed to opioid abuse. This legislature, led by State Representative Dave Baker from Willmar, who sadly lost his son as a result of opioid abuse, is working on legislation to further combat this scourge that affects communities and citizens in every corner of our state. This crisis is real, and the legislature is committed to action on this issue. Despite our strong economy and low unemployment rate, we can still bring more good-paying jobs to folks in Minnesota. Republicans are leading the fight here at the Capitol to allow projects like the Enbridge Line 3 replacement and the Polymet and Twin Metal mining projects to move forward so we can bring hundreds or even thousands of jobs to communities in northern Minnesota, bolstering our economy and helping further boost employment rates. These projects, in addition to providing huge numbers of good-paying new jobs, will generate millions of dollars in local property tax revenues for our local economies and ensure every part of our state can benefit from a prosperous and growing economy. We also will be looking to build our workforce to ensure that Minnesotans have the skills they need to fill these and other good-paying jobs. For the first time in a long time, there are now more job openings than job seekers. We hear from employers across the state that more and more training programs are needed for specialized job openings they are struggling to fill. These are good jobs with fulfilling career paths for folks, and we have put a major emphasis on vocational education, as well as prioritizing our two-year technical schools by freezing tuition for thousands of students at Minnesota State campuses. Part of our workforce development strategy is a new proposal rolled out this week that would require able-bodied, childless adults to look for work, or participate in a job training program to receive certain public welfare benefits. Medical assistant enrollment has dramatically increased under Governor Dayton's watch, and spending on this program will continue rising if we don't make common sense and needed reforms. This proposal will help boost our workforce participation rate, move people out of poverty, off of public programs, and give people the skills they need to succeed in Minnesota's economy. These requirements already exist for other programs at the federal level, and it's common sense for us to apply them here in Minnesota as well. Republicans are focused on putting policies in place that lift Minnesotans up and allow them to achieve their full potential. Growing government's footprint and increasing the number of people on public programs only increases people's dependence on government, limiting their potential and their ability to succeed and chart their own path. Moving able-bodied folks off of public programs will help preserve those programs for those who truly need it, the disabled, the elderly, children, and pregnant mothers. Minnesota's future is bright and our economy is in strong shape. Republicans are committed to continuing the important work we've accomplished over the past few years, fixing problems that arise and helping every Minnesotan achieve their full potential. With strong schools, solid infrastructure, a well-trained workforce, and a government that places Minnesota's citizens, not itself, at the center, we can ensure our state remains the best state in the nation for generations to come. Thank you for your time tonight. I appreciate the opportunity.
And thank you very much, Representative Fabian. Representative Dan Fabian, who is the Assistant Majority Leader of the Minnesota House of Representatives, delivering the Republican response to Governor Mark Dayton's State of the State Address here on Minnesota News Network. Thank you, Representative Fabian.
You're welcome.
Let's close the broadcast here with Professor Schultz and talk a little bit about one of the things that the representative touched on in his remarks responding to the governor's State of the State Address, and that's the gun issue.
Yes.
Okay, and the governor saluted the students who walked out. out of class today. I think it's fair to say, and Representative Fabian alluded to it and the governor alluded to it, that they can agree on school security measures, right, mental health assistance for students who need it in some way, shape, right, or form. Is it reasonable to assume they would agree on that?
I think so. I think everybody shares the goal of safe schools, and that people shouldn't worry about having to face violence when they go to school. I think everybody agrees on that.
And how they actually end up doing it, that remains to be seen. Right. But I think it's probably a high degree of probability that they will do that. But then there are the other issues, such as criminal background checks.
That's right.
And that's the one that's only the most prominent, but there are other proposals out there as well. In an election year, these things are coming forward. Does it happen? Does any of it happen? Does it depend on if some of it happens at the national level? Or what is your sense, Professor?
Well, it does look like it's going to happen at the national level also now, because
yeah, right,
we now see that Trump has sort of pretty much backed away from some of his earlier statements, and at most he's willing to support at this point arming teachers in schools.
Right.
I suspect that's a non-starter in Minnesota. I'm not hearing the Republicans.
I would think so.
Yeah, yes. I don't hear the Republicans talking about that also. But I think this is an interesting dividing point. Before we went on the air, I was mentioning to you, I saw some statistics today that Minnesota is, I think, in like the top 15 in terms of gun ownership in the country. I think it's like about a third of Minnesotans, have guns. I can't remember if it's Minnesotans or household. But the point is that the debate is, you're not going to see a debate which talks about seriously saying that what we're going to do is any major gun initiatives in terms of, let's say, assault rifle bans, registries, things like that, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that's going to happen. I think what we're going to see in terms of anything for schools will be what? It might be more in terms of mental health. It might be more in terms of, I've heard the representative here say, supporting resource officers, maybe more security. But in terms of, we're going to call it gun control.
Straight up gun control measures.
Not going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen.
Okay, Professor David Schultz, on one of the big issues that came up in both the State of the State address tonight and also in the Republican response, the gun issue, and that one is going to just continue to play out as students presumably will continue walking out of class and groups will continue converging on the Capitol as this legislative session continues on into May. So with that, we will end our coverage of the 2018 State of the State address of Governor Mark Dayton, his final address here at the State Capitol. And thank you, Professor David Schultz, Hamline University professor. And thank you, Emmett and Scott Peterson, for joining us from the House floor as well.
You're welcome.
I'm Bill Werner, Minnesota News Network. Good evening.